This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Everyone takes the ferry in Istanbul. It's how the city gets from one side to the other. But stay on board a little longer and you arrive at the Prince's Islands, a cluster of nine islands southeast of Istanbul in the Sea of Marmara. Once places of exile for royals, today they're something else entirely. And on the island of Büyükada, local businesswoman Mina Akdar and her family have been enjoying the unique pace of life here for generations.
Büyükada is a place where time stands still. And as soon as you step onto the island, you feel at peace and you feel relaxed. Walking around, exploring different beaches, I think it's just wonderful for anyone who's interested in beautiful places.
Just an hour from the hustle and bustle of the city, yet a world away, the Prince's Islands are a place where doing less somehow feels like more. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The Chancellor's first budget last week was not conceived in haste. Rachel Reeves waited nearly 4 months to deliver it, and naturally there was a flurry of instant responses to individual tax measures. But what about the big picture? Well, more than a week has passed and the dust is settling, and we thought it was time to return to a panel of experts who we spoke to in September. Is this really a once-in-a-generation budget? What will it mean for government's finances and services? Will it bring much-needed growth? And what might the re-election of Donald Trump mean for the British economy? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. With me, reunited, I have Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Marian Khan, Economics Editor of The Times, and Chris Giles, Economics Commentator at The Financial Times. Now, the last time we four met on the programme, we were talking about the state of the economy, the medium and long-term problems, and what the Chancellor might do in her first budget to address them. So we had the budget and we've had the instant analyses and complaints. But what I want to ask you first is, Marian Khan, was it a big change budget?
It was. And I think so much of what we're going to talk about today, we didn't mention in our show in September. So that's a bit of a health warning about how bad we are with predictions. But I think it surprised everyone, even though, as you said, it took 4 months or 117 days to prepare this budget. I was surprised. Everyone was surprised by the level of borrowing, the level of taxation and the level of spending. Rachel Reeves did manage to do more. It was a bigger in every way budget than we could have thought.
OK, that's quite interesting, Paul Johnson, because my kind of recollection of the discussion was that in a way you had laid out the constraints on Rachel Reeves and the things that she needed to do. And broadly speaking, she seemed to me like she was addressing them. So do you think it was such a big budget, like as Marian says?
I think my view on this has kind of changed actually over the last week as I've come to internalise it a bit. I think it's much less of a big budget than I thought it was. The tax rises are not big compared with what we had in the last parliament, actually. I think if we look back in 20 years' time, we'll see this budget as part of the 2020s, which will be the decade when the British state grew dramatically. And actually, I think the Chancellor's going to be come back for more, because I think this was actually a holding budget, weirdly. Now, this seems really bizarre, given how big these numbers are. I think it's a holding budget in three senses. First, she really kicked the spending can down the road. So the numbers she's penciled in for spending growth after next year are very small. And that's partly because she's really hemmed in by her fiscal rules.
Smaller than is realistic.
I think so. Right. So I think she'll come back there. There was no reform at all in this budget. No tax reform, no any other kind of reform. So I hope she comes back on that. There was a big investment money here, so long-term growth, good. But there wasn't anything in here, really, beyond that big investment for growth over this parliament. And I think we'll get a series, I hope, of announcements over the next year or so. So in that sense, actually, less of a dramatic budget, less setting the agenda for the whole parliament than perhaps I thought it might be.
OK, Chris, you get to adjudicate. So we have one big budget, one not so big budget. What do you think?
Can I say it's simultaneously big and small at the same time? It's big in terms of the tax raises, £40 billion. As Paul said, we had some very big tax raising budgets under the last government, but that is a historically large amount. It's more than 1% of national income. So I think that is a big budget. But why I say it's small at the same time is we're not going to get anything new for that. We're essentially using that additional tax money to pay for things that we already thought we were paying for, because we're doing a big cleanup job trying to make everything essentially work out and add up for the next 5 years. And that's all we've done. So it's all basically getting us back to what we thought was a sensible amount of investment, a sensible level of we are actually paying for the public services, and we've just got to pay a lot more tax for that. So it won't be a very popular budget, I don't think, because no one's going to feel better off from what they get from it, but we are going to pay a lot more tax.
OK, so that characterises as a good housekeeping budget, possibly not that much more than that. Now, you were all three of you right in the last programme we did about the fiscal rule being changed. Can you remind us, Miriam, what she's actually done about the fiscal rule and how the markets have responded to it?
So we spoke a lot in September about how hemmed in the Chancellor is because of the promises she made, basically not to raise income tax, not to raise VAT, not to raise national insurance, and because she had this inheritance, which was a fiscal rule that was really didn't have much breathing space for her to do borrowing. So once we sort of, I guess, hit publish on the episode, then loads of speculation came out about the options that the Chancellor needed to change her fiscal rule. The one that she went with, something, I hate using the term, but she changed the measure of the debt to something called public sector net financial liabilities. It's probably not that important, the technicalities of it, but it basically opened up a bit of the borrowing breathing room by including different types of assets that the government holds on its balance sheet. And she kind of had to do that because she was left with a few billions from Jeremy Hunt, and really there was nowhere to go. And once we had this £22 billion black hole, we knew that the Chancellor had to get creative with these fiscal rules. How did the markets react? It was very well trailed. About a week before the budget was announced, the Chancellor was in Washington. She told the media that she was going to be moving to a more expansive measure of the debt, which is all a way to make sure that nobody in the financial markets is very surprised by the fact that we're using a different measure of the debt. It's all to make sure that there's no nasty surprises, no Liz Truss kind of tricks to be played on investors. How did they react? We can say for sure now, a week later, that the amount of money the government pays to service the debt went up, and that's reflected in gilt yields. They went up on short-rated debt and they went up on 10-year debt. So as we speak, the 10-year gilt is at 4.5%. I think that's the highest in about 18 months. And a lot of the selling was done on the shorter end, which is a reflection of the fact that the markets think that inflation might be a bit stickier as a result of this budget and we might get fewer interest rate cuts. So there's different things going on. But I think all in all, it did not trigger a debt crisis. We haven't had a financial panic as a result of the budget. And that's partly because of a lot of the groundwork about what the fiscal rules were going to be changed to was put in place weeks before the Chancellor got up at the dispatch
box.
Paul,
what did you make of the change?
As Maureen says, the key rule that looked like it was going to bind was this rule that debt should be falling in 5 years' time. And on the previous definition, that rule has been clearly broken. But the Chancellor moved to a different definition of debt. To the extent that changing this definition has allowed her to do more investment for the long term, and I think much more importantly, she is constrained by her other fiscal rule, which is that she can borrow only to invest, I think that's probably okay, because I think we do, as I said before, the good thing about this budget is it did have an eye on 20 and 30 years' time. Actually, what does investment now do for the economy in the long run? As long as she keeps to that other fiscal rule, that she's borrowing only to invest, then I think we're okay. Her problem, again, is that she's only just meeting that rule. It's really very close, and it's actually pretty close on this debt rule as well, even after she's changed the definition. So she's got very little room for manoeuvre. If things move against her, interest rates go up a bit more, if the economy increases a bit less quickly than expected, then I'm afraid we're going to have all the speculation for the next budget. How is she going to deal with her really difficult fiscal situation?
Chris, Charles, it raises a really interesting point. The Speaker, I seem to recall, was actually rather cross with the Chancellor for having trailed what she was going to do in advance. But the way in which Paul and Maureen have described it, it was actually rather a sensible thing for her to do.
Yes, I'm with Paul and Maureen, not with the Speaker on this one. I think if she had gone to Parliament and announced the level of increase in borrowing she had with absolutely no warning whatsoever, then the market reaction could have been significantly worse than it was. As it was, there was a very nervy hour after she sat down where you were getting movements in government borrowing costs, rather like the scale you saw after Liz Truss's mini-budget in September 2022. Now, that did calm down, but there were a couple of nervy days.
Why did it calm down?
It calmed down because I think, essentially, two things. One is that, as Paul says, the money was being spent not just to give money away, it was being spent for investment. That's essentially where the new borrowing is going. And secondly, I think what markets felt ultimately was that they saw there was a plan, which was verified by the OBR, for actually really tight consolidation of the public finances. So after 2025-26, so after April 2025, what we're seeing is really tight spending plans and higher taxes, and that is what's going to reduce borrowing. Now, that has to happen, but markets see that. They're happy that there is actually a plan to get borrowing back down again.
Paul Johnson, can we dig in a little bit more to what you think were the most significant actual measures in the budget?
Three big things, I suppose. One is obviously this big increase in employer national insurance contributions. That's a very big tax increase in its own right, something like £25 billion straight off the bat. Not all of that net will occur because wages will fall and so on, which means less in the way of other taxes. But that's clearly a big tax rise and one that a lot of employers understandably have been complaining about. Secondly, is this big increase in investment spending, very much different to what previous chancellors have done in similar situations. A lot of it's for net zero type things. A lot of it's for things like schools and hospitals. So it's not actually necessarily laser focused on growth, but it's a big increase in investment spending. And the third is this remarkable in-year increase in spending on public services. So lots more money this year for the health service, the justice system and local government and so on, and more next year. The worry about that, and Chris just referred to it in a sense, is in principle, it then gets really tight after next year. I mean, I'm not sure that's what's really going to happen.
Marion, I was going to ask a question which related to that. Which of the measures do you think in this budget are essentially hostages to fortune? In other words, we can't be at all sure that they will work or that they will have the impact that the government has designed for them.
So I think the OBR in total has to do all of the costings. And I think there are about 17 of the tax measures where the OBR was a bit on shaky ground about what impact this would have. So we know that one of the reasons that the Chancellor was pushed into doing this bolder move on employer national insurance is because a lot of the taxes that Labour have told us about in the manifesto, things like carried interest on private equity or changes to capital gains and inheritance tax, once they got put through the kind of OBR model, they just didn't raise that much money and definitely not enough to fill this £22 billion black hole. So the OBR does provide a bit of a health warning on a lot of these 17 tax measures, as I said, that could really just not be lucrative as we expect because of behavioural changes. So this is the idea that will rich people flee the UK because they're worried about the changes in capital gains tax, which actually are more modest than some of the ones that were trailed. We already have angry farmers about the changes to inheritance tax. They didn't really do anything on pensions. That's probably a result of a lot of the furore around the winter fuel payment, as Labour already kind of going after older people. So they did less about hitting pension pots. And that's why employer NICS is really carrying a lot of the weight. But even that one, which is costed at something around £26 billion, the OBR says, well, if you really think about it in the whole, it's going to probably reduce the number of jobs. It's probably going to raise £8 billion less, so something around the £16 to £18 billion mark.
Well, that pensions point takes me, Chris, to this question about what was dodged. And what Maureen suggests is that if you hadn't gone for the winter fuel payment, you might have got a larger amount that you could have got from pensions.
They did get some money from pensions because the favourable inheritance tax treatment of defined contribution lump sum pots has been essentially taken away. But they didn't go for the tax-free lump sum, which is a quarter of pension pots, and they didn't go for pension contributions. Both of those could have raised significant sums if they'd gone, not necessarily being very good ideas. But the big thing they dodged, just like the last government, so not a big change, petrol duties. They have not been raised now since 2010 or 2011, essentially for 15 years. It's quite hard to see a government ever raising them now because they're clearly very scared of the motoring lobby. And it's not as if oil prices are high at the moment. And it's not as if UK petrol prices are high compared with European petrol prices. They used to be, but they're not anymore.
Twice when my forehead hit the table during the speech, and that was one of them. You can't do it now when it's relatively cheap as part of a £40 billion tax rising package. It's probably never going to happen. And yet we maintain the fiction in all of these public finance numbers we've been talking about that next year it'll go up.
You said it was the second time your head hit the table. What was the first?
Oh, when they increased stamp duty. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. The worst tax that we have, and they go and decide to increase it. Now, to be fair, only on second properties, but that also reduces transactions in the housing market. It will have a knock-on effect increasing rents because it will mean there are fewer landlords. The temporary reduction in stamp duty on lower value houses and first-time buyers is going to come to an end in April. So we're going to have a rush to buy houses at the end of March. Why? I do not understand why they increase stamp duty on second properties. I'm not a landlord, I should say. It's not going to affect me. But this is bad for the housing market. It's bad for mobility. I don't get it.
Now, what we had today is another cut in interest rates. Miriam, is this a part of a pattern of likely future cuts? And what will that mean for the Chancellor's own predictions?
I think the Chancellor was really hoping that 25 basis points now nearly every other month is something that the government would love. I actually think that to make a lot of the numbers in this budget add up, monetary policy will have to do a lot of work. And it will have to do a lot of the work to pick up that growth slack that the OBR thinks that we're going to be maybe falling into in 2026 onwards. So effectively, we've had interest rates rising at the fastest rate in 40 years. That really hurts people because one, inflation is high and they're worried about their mortgages, which in this country, most people are fixed between a 2 and a 5 year rate. So somebody, eventually, you're going to feel that pain somewhere. I think the Bank of England, and the Chancellor mentions a lot that she worked at the Bank of England, is actually now going to be a bit braver in cutting interest rates after being very cautious and very slow in 2024. So we only had 2 interest rate cuts this year. The ECB or the Eurozone, they've had more in the US, they're doing them at a faster pace. She's really going to be hoping that the bank realises or thinks and understands that inflation is coming down. It's not going to reemerge. And we should get back to a place where interest rates, now 4.75%, in the Chancellor's ideal world, is somewhere closer to around a 2 or 3% level, which is currently lower than what the market thinks, to help provide a boost to people's real incomes.
And presumably, Chris Giles, a more stable investment background. And that brings me to the next kind of big area here, which is, very broadly, tricky question, how much do we have to grow in order to not get poorer in this country?
Well, using really broad brush figures, if the economy grows at about the 1% rate it has over the past 5 or 6 years on average, then we're really not going to get richer because that's what happened in the past. If we can get to the pre-global financial crisis level of 2 to 3%, then we will start feeling better off for certain. But we shouldn't, with all these tax increases coming in, shouldn't necessarily expect that our incomes are going to rise significantly in real terms in the rest of this decade. And maybe that is, as Paul said earlier in the programme, just one of those things, because we are now in a decade of rapidly ageing population where we have to spend more, or the government has to spend more money to buy just the same level or quality of services as it used to. The whole population has to pay for that, and so it has to be spread around slightly fewer people, and that means we pay more to get just the same amount, and so it doesn't necessarily feel great.
Paul, in what sense can we say that the budget was a budget that set the scene for future growth?
I think it helps with growth in the very long term. So that investment spending will help with the size of the economy 10, 20, 30 years hence.
Which, 10 or 30?
Well,
I'm still alive. 30, probably.
It will build up over time if that level of investment spending is maintained. But it's not going to make a big difference. In terms of this Parliament, I don't think this was a budget for growth. What the Office of Budget Responsibility says is growth will be a bit bigger this year and next because basically the chance of chucking a load of money at the economy and then a bit slower after that because taxes are up and actually maybe inflation and interest rates will be a bit higher than they otherwise would have been. And indeed, the OBR, if you look at their forecasts for what will happen to household incomes, the good news is that it predicts they'll grow faster this parliament than the last parliament. The bad news is that'll make it the second worst parliament in history for household income growth. So I think for growth, I don't think this was the budget which sets the agenda. I think we are waiting to hear what is going to happen to competition policy, what is going to happen to planning, what is going to happen to trade, what is going to happen to regulation, what is going to happen to tax reform. That wasn't part of this budget. As Chris said, this is kind of, to some extent, just housekeeping.
Right, so this is the good housekeeping, and it was a budget that didn't frighten the horses. But what will determine significant growth is what is to come.
That will be the hope and the expectation. I mean, that none of that is easy, and all of that only has an effect in the longer term. So, you know, might just about be making a difference by the end of the parliament. And that's always one of the really tough bits about how economics and politics interact, that sustainable economic growth can be achieved by government policy, but it takes a long time. The sorts of things that need to happen, planning reform is the obvious one, the government's talked a lot about it, there are trade-offs, and the impact takes a while to come, which is, as I say, one of the reasons I'm so encouraged by the fact that Chancellor has focused on the long term with her investment plans.
Marion Carr, one of the things that always used to get said is if the government has big investment plans, i.e. it tends to invest itself, it will crowd out private investment. Is that still a legitimate argument? Is that still one that runs?
Depends who you ask. And it depends over what time frame. So actually, the OBR does think that maybe in the short run, 26, 27, 28, there will be a crowding out effect. So I think capital private investment goes down towards the end of the decade. And then, as Paul said, that in the 2030s, where we get the supply side of the economy grows, they do think that the crowding out effect diminishes and that the private sector that's been sitting on the sides waiting to invest is suddenly going to unleash that money. These are all assumptions that the OBI is making. If you ask people who are more left-leaning, they think the crowding out thing is a little bit of a moral panic. I think it's a questionable assumption that the OBR makes. The OBR makes lots of questionable assumptions. I guess one of the reasons its growth forecast is a little bit more pessimistic is because it's been so optimistic for so long. Ultimately, what Rachel Reeves is banking on is that a lot of the pessimistic judgments the OBR makes just don't become reality. So the interest rates fall a bit faster, the inflation falls faster, there isn't really a crowding out effect. Consumers feel better from the fact that rates are going down and their mortgages are going down. And actually, that tricky end part of the parliament is just not as gloomy as it's been painted out.
Chris, Giles, one of the things that has changed very significantly in the last week, of course, has been the election in America, which means that Donald Trump will be inaugurated again as president in January, committed to really substantial tariffs on foreign goods. If, as we understand his plans at the moment, he seeks to carry them out and is successful, what would that mean for us?
Well, let me say what it means for the US. If he went for a 10 to 20% tariff with a 60% surcharge on Chinese goods, which is where he says he will do it, that would put the US tariff rate back to the 1930s level, the Great Depression era. So that is a very, very large policy. We don't know whether he is just using it as a negotiating tactic. Two of his former advisors have told us in interviews it's just negotiation. He's just a businessman. This is what he does. Another one, who was his trade representative in the last time he was president, said, no, actually, he means it. We are going to do this. So even his closest advisors don't agree whether it's happening. So let's just assume it does happen. That is a big policy for the whole global economy and will almost certainly have retaliation from China, from Europe, from other countries where tariffs are applied. And let's face it, the very unfortunate fact is that economic models are fantastically bad at coming up with sensible predictions for really big structural breaks, because they haven't been estimated on that. They've been estimated on very small changes happening. And so when you see some of these estimates, you think, no, that's far, far too small. And I'll give one example. Very recently, last month, the International Monetary Fund came up with what it was trying to suggest was a shocking outlook for the global economy if you had a Trump policy with tariffs, with migration control, with financial uncertainties. And the biggest effect it had on inflation in the world, 0.2 percentage points in any one year. It was nothing. And that, frankly, is not believable. If you had that sort of breakdown in geopolitical and economic cooperation in the world, like fundamental breakdown, things would be much bigger than that and not good.
Marion, I've already seen speculation that the British government would have one of two options. It's always one of two options, which is either get in with the Europeans so that you can fight tariff increases together, or get much closer to the Trump administration, dump the Europeans and hope that they're much nicer to Britain. Do either of these make sense?
I don't think it's going to be that binary, because we know what happened the first time that Trump was in office and it just wasn't that binary. I think there are important strategic decisions that will have to be accelerated that this government will have to make because of Trump. One is, this, as Chris has already mentioned, the idea of imposing tariffs. Now, so far, the UK has decided that it's going to be a bit of a anomaly and not impose tariffs on things like Chinese electric vehicles. And the government's argument for that is that we're not part of a large trading bloc, i.e. the EU. We are very exposed, so we're not going to go down the protectionism route. Now, we know that Donald Trump doesn't like it when countries join in with his little crusades against other nations like China. So I imagine a Trump administration would put the UK under much more pressure to join in with its bandwagon against China. And if it doesn't, then threaten it again. And the other one we should mention is defence spending. So we know from the first Trump administration that he had very clear ideas about the free riding that European nations do on NATO. The UK currently is committed to spend 2% of its GDP on defence spending, but it would like that to increase to 2.5%, but only by the end of this parliament. So that's in 2028, 2029. I imagine the Trump administration would want that 2.5% figure to be raised much quicker than the government is currently foreseeing it to do so. So that's another form of diplomatic pressure that the Trump administration could put on this government. And let's be honest, defence spending is just another fiscal pressure that we'll now have to think about much more seriously, given the change in administration in Washington.
Which leads me to my final question, Paul Johnson. What do you think Rachel Reeves, if she's still in post, will find herself doing in next year's budget?
Well, I think she will have just had an enormous row with her fellow cabinet ministers, because she will be needing, either at or before the budget next year, to set the spending review, set the spending totals for each department for the years after next year. And as we've said, the numbers available at the moment look incredibly tight. They would involve cuts to some departments. I don't think that's what will happen. I don't, having increased spending this year and next, it would be very, very odd then to say, oh, well, look, the justice system, for example, is just about recovering, now we're going to cut it again. But I don't think there's going to be a lot of money around. So I think the first thing she's going to be doing is having a big row with her colleagues. Second thing I rather fear is going to happen before the budget is we'll have yet another set of speculation about, is she going to raid pension pots? Is she going to do anything to the lump sum? Is she going to change capital gains tax? And again, lots of people changing their behaviour because they're worried about what she'll do. So I hope she gives us some certainty. But my guess is that she'll be coming back one way or another, actually, for more tax increases in order to maintain a higher level of spending. I hope that this time she also does some serious, proper, genuine reform to the tax system so that it is more growth friendly. A lot of it's difficult. Reductions in stamp duty, increases in council tax particularly for valuable properties, increases in income tax relative to national insurance contributions, because what happened last week just makes work more highly taxed relative to non-work income. Let's hopefully not just see an increase in petrol duties in line with inflation, but a plan for how we're going to tax cars when we're all going electric looking forward. She said she wants a radical overhaul of business rates. Their manifesto says it's going to abolish business rates. Let's find out what on earth that might mean. There's a few things for starters, but I could go on.
Mary, you're nodding.
Maybe they're just taking their time over it, which is why Paul's a little bit disappointed that it hasn't happened. But I remember him saying that you better to take your time and do it well.
Absolutely.
Than to do it quickly and do it wrong.
Yep. Next year will be fine with me.
Is that they still have the mandate to do unpopular big things in the first 2 years of this parliament. And that's why there's a lot of front loading. That's why I still think the budget exceeded expectations. And if you were going to do slightly more complicated things like reform, I think council tax would be incredibly... I'm just thinking about my own paper's editorial that would come out on the day that we change council tax. These are things that are really going to generate a lot of attention, but this is probably the only time that you have the political capital, so you might as well spend it on doing the tough stuff. And she's already shown that she doesn't mind doing things that only give you a political dividend, maybe outside of the electoral window of 5 years. The things around capital investment are very much the good things that you do, even though they might not give you benefit electorally.
And Chris, what do you think?
If she's lucky, so let's say interest rates come down without growth being low, just the opposite of what happened in 2022, then she'll spend more and ease the spending review process for the rest of the parliament. If she's unlucky, she'll tax more and we'll go through exactly the process we went through before this budget of lots of speculation, because we'll know before the budget whether things are looking good or things are looking bad.
We have to end it there. My thanks to Berin Khan, Chris Giles and Paul Johnson. And my conclusion... Only 35 briefing rooms to the next budget. Just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about falling birth rates across the world, the one on planning reform, and the one on university funding. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Charlotte MacDonald, Diane Richardson and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the sound engineers were Rod Farker and Never Missirian. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and I'm happy to tell you that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back with more conversations with people who fascinate me. In the new series, we'll hear from the comedian Miranda Hart.
Part of being human is that we are vulnerable.
The writer Irvin Welsh.
It's quite a thing to be 8 years old and then suddenly to have a criminal record.
And we'll begin with a conversation with the actor Minnie Driver.
What do you wish you'd understood about the movie business?
It's all ephemera. None of it is real.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.